This is the last lecture. We got a lot to cover. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وبعد. About the five awsaq, I quickly looked in a quick book and the author said 12 and a half kilograms. Now, I cannot verify his reasoning for that. So, just you can put that in your notes as one statement. And it needs to be looked into, okay? Because sometimes people, when trying to convert these measures, come with different equivalents. But one author said 12 and a half kilograms. Anyway, we now come to the ordering of evidences. We discussed about how to resolve evidences when they're conflicting, but how do we order them? This is known in Arabic as tartibul adilla. Tartibul adilla. Okay. First of all, the first case is that we have all the evidences in agreement. Quran, Sunnah, Ijma' and Qiyas all point to this ruling. There's no problem here, right? And this is the majority of the major rulings in the religion. You will find evidence for it in the Quran, in the Sunnah, in the consensus, and also the Qiyas will indicate too. And if you look on page 9 of your little booklet, there's a paragraph regarding that. However, let's say we have the second case, we have one or more of these evidences point to a ruling, but there has no conflicting evidence. In other words, we can prove this by the Quran and the Sunnah. We can prove this by the Sunnah and the Ijma', but there's nothing in the Quran which points to this. So one or more of the four evidences, right, point to this ruling. And there's no conflicting ruling. This is also, I think the case is clear, right? Huh? Yes. Yeah, we're regarding source. And I mentioned earlier when we first did the Qiyas, a last lecture, that normally it's discussed when you do the evidences, but because the book which I was using to teach the course, the author treated it among some linguistical issues, I put it there. But in other books of the school of fiqh, will come after Ijma'. Okay. Now, case three. You have a conflict between these evidences. Okay. Now, we use both if possible. Like we, for instance, remember we applied the two general evidences, each to their specific case. We specified a general with a specific. We applied two specific evidences, each to a specific case. In that sense, if we can use both evidences, fine. If we cannot use both evidences, we then say, well, let's see if there's evidence which has abrogated the other evidence. If we cannot say what has abrogated the other, does that mean? Well, solve that problem. If we cannot say that one abrogated the other, all right, we adopt the stronger evidence. How do we know which is the stronger? let's try to put this in the bucket. Okay, how do we adopt the stronger evidence in this case? How do we say which evidence is stronger? Well, with regards to the Quran and the Sunnah, we put a nas over the zahir text. The nas over the zahir text. What was the nas? Remember it. No. Which has... Who said that? Yes, it's the explicit text, which only has one meaning, okay? What is the zahir text? Huh? It has two possible meanings, but one is stronger than the other, right? So in this case, we put the nas, right, over the zahir text. Why? It's got no other meaning, but the zahir, it's possible that maybe the weaker meaning is that the... So we put the nas over... Okay, now, and we put the zahir text over the ma'awwal text. What was the ma'awwal text? No, that's mujmal. What's the ma'awwal? That's the mujmal. They have two equal meanings. right, one less than the other, was the ma'ovah text. So in this case, the vahav text has two possible meanings. One is stronger than the other. The ma'ovah text has two possible meanings, but we've adopted the weaker meaning for some reason. So we put the one which is vahir over the one which is ma'ovah. Okay, the explicit, the mantuq, over the implied meaning, the mafhum. Remember we did the four types of mafhum? The three types of mafhum? You know, remember we did fahwa al-khitab, and nahnu al-khitab, and dalil al-khitab, mafhum al-muwafiqa, and mafhum al-mukharafa. This is the last thing we did yesterday. So we do it when it's implied, explicit, over the implied meaning. In other words, with the text, because what was the mafhum? The mafhum was when the text doesn't indicate to that meaning, right? But we use it because it is implied, okay? But the mantuq is when it's actually within the text, that meaning, so we put that above. We put the affirmed over the negated. In other words, in one hadith, the Prophet ﷺ, one companion says the Prophet did not pray inside the Kaaba. Another hadith says that he prayed inside the Kaaba, which we put, because it affirms a meaning as opposed to that which negates it. Because it has more knowledge. Okay? More knowledge. The affirmed over the negated because it has more knowledge. Okay? That which has moved from the general principle over that which has not. The general principle is that if you touch something of your body, it doesn't break your wudu. Right? In the hadith regarding if a man touches his private parts. One of the reasons why we chose that it breaks wudu, right? Because it has moved from the general principle. The general principle is that if you touch part of your body, it doesn't make wudu. But here it's moved from that general principle, so it has more knowledge. And so therefore, what do? We put that which has moved from the general principle over that which has not. General principle regarding things is that they are pure. So let's say we find an evidence which says something is najis, something is filthy. We choose that which is, because it has moved it from the general principle of things. General principle of things is that transactions, buying and selling, are all halal, except for that transaction, which the Sharia specifically says is forbidden. So here we have a conflicting evidence concerning two transactions, right? We take the rule that said it would be haram, because it has moved it from the general principle. Okay? You get what I'm saying by moving from the general principle? General principle is that... Okay, that's nothing enough example. Now, the general which has no specifier over the general which has been specified. In other words, two general texts, one has not been specified. And the general which has not been specified is called al-aam al-mahfuz. Al-aam al-mahfuz. Again, that is not pronounced Z, but it's pronounced Wa. So al-aam al-mahfuz is the general text which has no specifier. We put that over a general text which has been specified. Why? What would be the reason behind that? Think about it. A general text which has nothing to specify it, as opposed to a general text which has been specified. Why would we put that over? Yes? No, but we're saying we're putting over the general which has no specifier over that which has been specified. Covers more area. Right, it's general. It's still general. It has no specifier. So it covers more area. But the general which has been specified has now been restricted. So therefore we put that which covers more area over that which has been restricted, right? Okay, the stronger hadith over the weaker hadith. In other words, we take a hadith reported in Bukhari and Muslim over a hadith which has been reported in Abu Dawud, for instance. Okay? A hadith which is sahih over a hadith which is hasan. A hadith which has 10 chains of narration over a hadith which has one chain of narration. A hadith which the narrators are of stronger memory over hadith which the narrators are weaker memory. I mean, all the science of Musalah hadith would enter into this thing to determine which is the stronger over the weaker hadith. And finally, the person of the incident over the one who is not. Like the story of Maymunah and Ibn Abbas. Who knows better how the Prophet ﷺ was when he married Maymunah? Maymunah does. Because he's the individual of the incident. Okay? So, these are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 steps which we would use to try to determine which is the stronger evidence in dealing alaykum salam, so that we could adopt that stronger evidence if the two evidences are dealing with the Quran and the Sunnah. Any questions on these 8 steps? No? Speak up or whatever, hold your peace. What? Yes? Okay, remember, what are the definitions? We have Nas, Zahir, Mujmal, and Ma'awwal. A Nas is one that has only one possible meaning to that text. Like when Allah says the month of Ramadan, okay, for the fast. Can it mean the month of Shawwal? Can it mean the month of Sha'ban? There's only one possible meaning for that text, Ramadan, which is the ninth month of the Hijra year. Now, the Zahir, okay, is when it has two meanings, two possible meanings. One is more apparent, so it is the Zahir. The Mujmal has two equal meanings. We cannot determine which is the one, which is the strongest. And the Ma'awwal has two meanings. One is more apparent, but we have adopted the weaker one. For some reason. Some reason has led us to take the weaker meaning. And that process of taking the weaker meaning is known as ta'wil. Ta'wil. And the object of ta'wil is called the Ma'awwal text. So, the Nas is put over the Zahir, because the Nas has only one interpretation. There is no way we can go wrong. But the Zahir text, since it has two interpretations, even though one is stronger, there's a possibility that really the weaker interpretation is the one which is more correct. So we take that which is definite, we're having one interpretation, possibly only, as opposed to that which has two, okay? And over here, we take the Zahir over the Ma'awwal, because by default, the Ma'awwal is when we've taken the weaker interpretation. So obviously that which is more apparent is better than that which is weaker. Is that clear? Who asked the question after that? Yes, is it clear? Okay. So now we've discussed it regarding if the two conflicting evidences are from the Quran and Sunnah. What happens if it comes from Ijma? This was with these eight steps were with regards to the Quran and the Sunnah. Okay. You can put a little thing on the side saying with regards to the Quran and Sunnah. Okay. Okay. Can I go ahead and erase this? Okay, take your time. Give me a few minutes. Tell me we've finished writing this down, because we've got a lot of stuff to do. Last one, okay. Okay. Now, with regards to Ijma', who can quickly look in their notes and tell me the two types of Ijma'? Huh? That's right. What's the other one? Okay, don't worry about the Sukuti. It's the first two. What are the two types of Ijma'? Ijma' al-Qat'i, okay. Okay, Qat'i. And a Dhanni. And remember we said it's not za, but it's vanni. Okay, we put the qat'i over the vanni. Why? Huh? Clear cut. Right? As opposed to the vanni, which is not definite, right? Okay, so that's with regards to ijma'. We have two ijma's which are conflicting. We put an ijma' al-qat'i over an ijma' al-vanni. Because an ijma' al-qat'i is definite ijma'. Well, ijma' al-dhanni is just a probable ijma'. There's a possibility there's really no ijma'. Okay, now we come to the next one. With regards to qiyas. With regards to qiyas. What were the two types of qiyas? We just did last lecture. I don't have to go too far back in your notes. Huh? Two types of qiyas. Jelly, okay. That's jelly, right? And al-khafi. What do you think we put forward? Al-jelly. We put al-jelly over al-khafi. All right? Al-jelly over al-khafi. Because al-jelly is what? Apparent. While al-khafi is qiyas, which is not apparent. Because the illah in the jelly qiyas has been specified by the text or by ijma'ah. While in the khafi, we've deduced the illah. So therefore, we could be mistaken. So if we have two qiyases, one is jelly and one is khafi, we put forward the jelly qiyas over the khafi qiyas. All right, very good. Now let us come to the final subject, alhamdulillah, of usul al-fiqh. You never thought you'd make it here, huh? Number 9. Who can remember the definition of usul al-fiqh? What was the definition? Huh? General evidence is right? What was the last part of the definition of usul al-fiqh? That is of who? Huh? The one who makes ijtihad. So this is the last thing, right? About the status, right, of the one who gives ijtihad. So number 9 in our notes is the ijtihad. Ijtihad. Okay. First thing we're going to discuss is al-mufti and al-mustafti. The mufti is the one who gives the fatwa. He gives the answer to a question asked. And mustafti is the one who asks the question. Very good. So, in order to give a fatwa, all right, in order to give a fatwa, there are conditions. So, stipulations for giving a fatwa. That he knows the ruling with certitude or probability. And this is one. Remember, we did the types of knowledge. We said there was that knowledge which was one. What was the knowledge which was one knowledge? Huh? What? No, that's not what it is. Right. I mean, there's two possibilities, but one is more probable, okay? So either you have certitude, you know, you have full knowledge, right? Certitude, the Arabic word is yaqeen. Okay? Or you have one. You have one. So you don't have certitude concerning the ruling, but there's two possibilities, and you think that this is the stronger possibility for you. Okay, that he has understood the question in full. Okay? Has understood the question in full. In other words, you come to a mufti and you ask him a question. In order for him to give the ruling, he must know the answers, the ruling, but also he must understand the question fully. He cannot partially understand the question, yes? Yeah, with either certitude or possibility, right? It says that, you know, sometimes the rulings, like for instance, if somebody asks you a question, okay, does, a new Muslim comes to you, does going to the bathroom, urinating, break my wudu? That's something you know out of certainty. There's no doubt concerning that, right? Other ruling, right? like the exchange for apples for apples of unequal quantities, hand to hand. Okay? This is something which is one, probably is riba. So somebody asks you concerning that. There's not certitude that it's riba, but it's probably riba. So you would say it's riba. Third, that he is not agitated. Or not paying attention and so forth. I mean, the Mufti is going to give a judgment. So if he's agitated, if he's thinking about something else, right? If he's sleepy, if he's hungry, the fetwa might not come out as it's supposed to come out. So for a person, the stipulation of giving a fetwa, you must know the ruling, either with certitude or probability, one. You must understand the question in full, and you yourself must not be agitated, sleepy, hungry, tired, which might make you, right, be hateful and not give the correct fetwa. Okay? Now, have we got these three conditions out? Yes? But if you could prove that, right, that would knock out his fetwa. I was giving you an example last night of the lecture I gave in Sheffield, that in the early 80s, a scholar came to us, okay, from Egypt, he's passed away. I mean, he's one of the great scholars of the Ummah in his day. When asked regarding the ruling concerning credit cards, okay, he had never heard or seen of credit cards before. They were not introduced at that time into Egypt. So, you know, they tried to explain it to him, and he gave a ruling. If somebody then said, well, look, the sheikh does not know what a credit card is, I cannot accept his ruling. Okay? Obviously, it's a valid statement. If you can prove that there's an external evidence, right, of external pressure, that's a valid statement. But how can you prove these things? And that's the point, right? I mean, is it just mere suspicion, or is it actual proof? Anyway, let's continue on. Okay? What? Number three. He is not agitated or not paying attention, or he's not hungry, or he's not sleepy, or he's not tired. In other words, when giving the fatwa, he should be a calm mind and disposition. Okay, you come to a sheikh and he's, you know, sleepy, you know, he just come back from a trip, and you ask him a question, right? He should really hold himself, but let's say he gives you an answer and he sort of mumbles it out. You know, he might not have really thought of the issue very carefully. And if you ask him, maybe after he took a nap or something like that, might give you a different answer. So that's stipulations for giving a fatwa. Alright. Can we take this? Okay. We still have a few things to do. We don't have much time, brother. So. Two. When can a mufti not answer a fatwa? Or a question, let's say. A fatwa. Three cases. The situation does not exist. You should not answer the question. For instance, somebody asked me a question. I'm not a mufti, but so let's say somebody asked a mufti a question. The Irish Republican Army is sweeping down from Scotland and going to take over London. Okay? Are the Muslims allowed to join the common defense forces? I hope there's nobody Irish in the audience. Of the London defense forces. Okay? This is something that does not occur, right? It's just a completely hypothetical issue, right? And so therefore the situation does not exist, the Mufti should not answer the question. All right? Right? Okay. Well, Bill Clinton invited the guy from Sean Fence or Shin Fence, so don't get angry. All right. Number two, the questioner seeks to follow his desires or cause confusion, etc. In other words, the questioner, you sense that basically he's trying just to follow the easiest opinion. Or the questioner is trying to elicit different responses from the scholars in order to regard, you know, make them, say, well, look, this scholar said this, and this scholar said this, you know, this type of confusion, in order to cause some sort of fitna, right? In this case, the Mufti can hold back from speaking by saying, you know, this person is obviously not seeking an answer to apply it, but is seeking to try to cause some sort of fitna. Yes? We'll get to that. But let's just take it. The point is that when can the Mufti hold back from the fatwa? The situation does not exist. He should hold back. Number two, the questioner seeks to follow his desires or cause confusion or some sort of, you know, striking between the same as the scholars, he should hold back. All right? We understand the second case? Three, it will lead to greater harm. For example, if you're answering the question, you know it might lead the person to leave the religion. Person's faith is weak. And so therefore, by answering his question, you know it's going to elicit a response in him that will make him leave the religion. You should not answer the question here. The Mufti should hold silent. Or you know that he would act in a certain way which would result in a greater evil occurring. For instance, somebody comes to you and says, all right, what is the ruling regarding a certain ruler? Regarding a certain ruler. And you know the ruler is an unbeliever. He's apostate from the religion of Islam. But yet you understand the Muslims in your country do not have sufficient means to remove the ruler by force. And you see this youth, you feel that by telling him that, he might go try to take a gun and shoot the ruler, thereby resulting in the ruler, most likely he'll fail, thereby resulting in the ruler taking all the brothers who have beards, right, and throwing them in prison or so forth, okay? In this case, if the Mufti remains silent because he feels it will lead to a greater harm, this is permissible for him to do. Okay, or the other example, somebody asks you a question, you sense that their faith is weak, by answering them is going to cause them to leave Islam. You should be silent in this case. Anytime it's going to, the answer is going to result in a greater harm. Okay, now let us come. What is required upon the Mustafti? The Mustafti has elicited a fatwa from the Mufti. What is required upon the Mustafti? So there's a difference between the Mufti and the judge. The Mufti and the Qadi is the judge, right? The Qadi, his judgment is binding. You come to a court, Sharia court, and you go to the Qadi, his judgment is binding, it is enforced. And so therefore, no other Qadi can repel his judgment. He's the Qadi, he's the judge, and he's his force. The Mufti, right, only tells you what is Allah's religion, but he has no way of enforcing it. So he tells you this is halal, this is haram, and so forth, right? For instance, you come to the Mufti, and you come to the issue that I killed a person. What is the ruling? Well, Either you have to pay blood witch, or up to the boss, right, and so forth, if you murder somebody. But that it ends there. The qadi, though, right, will enforce Allah's judgment because he's a judge. Right? One of the conditions for a qadi is that he should be able to possess the shihad and he should be able to. Excuse me? Yes, there can be. If you have two Muslims come to a person who possesses the conditions to be a qadi and ask him to dispute, to judge, or to resolve the dispute between them, his judgment is binding. Okay. What is required of the mustafti? What is required of the mustafti? One, or A, that he speaks the truth. B, he solicits a fatwa from the most knowledgeable and trustworthy Muslim. In other words, whoever he feels is most knowledgeable, most pious, he should try to elicit the response of him, whenever possible. Okay, any questions concerning Mufti and Mustafti? Can he go, with the question, can he go to another Mufti again? He feels the Mufti has not given him judgment by what Allah reveals, or he feels doubt concerning the proof of that Mufti, he can go to another Mufti, provided he's seeking the truth. And not just trying to wait until he finds an opinion which agrees with his desire. The ruling of Mufti is never binding upon a person because he has no authority to put that into force. All he's doing is he's informing you of Allah's ruling. It's voluntary compliance with Allah's ruling. Huh? Yeah. Well, the Qadi, outside of his jurisdiction, has no, you know, way. I mean, for instance, if the Imam of the Muslims selected you as the Qadi of the people of London, right? And the Imam of the Muslims selected you as the Qadi of the people of Edinburgh, right? He has no jurisdiction over the Muslims of London to enforce judgments, right? He's the Qadi of Edinburgh. But now, for instance, if the Imam of the Muslims selected you to be the Qadi of all the Muslims in the United Kingdom, then therefore, you would be that. You have the right to enforce a judgment in Edinburgh or in London because you're a general qadi, so therefore all these Muslims fall under your jurisdiction. Yes. We're going to come to that in a second. But in general, the rule is that, look, when you have if you do not have a qadi who has reached the level of a qadi, right, you choose the most knowledgeable and the least impious of two impious qadis and two ignorant qadis. In other words, we have two ignorant people. One of them has to be a qadi, the least ignorant. Two impious qadis, the least impious. Two muftis, right? None of them have reached the level of jihad. The most knowledgeable, the most pious of the two. I mean, we take the best of the worst situation. I mean, we mean by ignorance, we don't mean complete ignorance, where they don't even know how to read a fatiha, right? Okay, quickly, because we just have a little time left. Now, let us come now to ijtihad. The ijtihad. Its definition is to exercise one's utmost effort to reach Allah's ruling. Okay? Two, there is no ijtihad where there is a text. If there's a verse, if there's a hadith, if there's an ijma', there's no ijtihad. It's already been determined. Three, conditions required to give an ijtihad, to exercise ijtihad. Exercise ijtihad. What are the conditions that one must have to exercise ijtihad? Okay. One, or A, that he knows versus dealing with judgment, and the hadith dealing with judgment. Okay. We said that, you know, fiqh deals with judgments, rulings. It doesn't deal with aqidah. So the verses of the Quran that deal with rulings, judgments, you know, like wajib and mubah and haram and so forth, they deal with the matters of fiqh, like fahara and salah, and marriage and divorce and buying and selling. The mujtahid has to know these verses. And there are about 500 in number. There are approximately 500 verses. Okay? As far as the hadith dealing with judgment, we'll get the number to the 5 or 6 text we're using. Okay. As far as the hadith dealing with judgment, there are about 2,000 hadith, and some scholars push them up to about 10,000. So this is probably the stronger number. About 2,000 hadith. If you look at a book like Bulugh al-Maram, it has about, what, about 1,500 hadith, and something like that, 1,800 hadith. That's close to most of the hadith dealing with judgment. Anyway, scholars differ between any giving numbers between 2,000 and 10,000, but it's probably closer to the lower end, about 2,000 hadith. So if you know these 500 verses, you know these 2,000 hadith, that's the first stipulation to be able to do ijtihad. What? Huh? Excuse me? It's about 500 verses. Number two, regarding these hadith, you have to know issues regarding the validity of these hadith. Like, is it sahih or da'if? Right? And so forth. What is the cause of its weakness? Right? How many chains of narration? What makes it stronger than the other hadith? And everything dealing with the validity of those hadith, the authenticity of those hadith, you need to know. Three, you need to know the abrogated and the abrogated regarding these hadith and verses, which ones abrogated the other. The You have to know where there is ijma. On these matters. Is the ijma' qat'i or dhanni? Okay? You have to know usul al-fiqh and the Arabic language. You can make that e and make it f, the Arabic language. Ask the other client, let's take it to two. Regarding the interpretation of these verses in the hadith, remember we discussed? Like, how do we know if this indicates that it's a command? How do we know if it indicates that it is a prohibition? How do we know if it's enough? How do we know if it's zahir? How do we know if it's ma'awwal? How do we know if it's mafhum al-muwasakha? How do we know if it's mafhum al-mukhalafa? Well, this needs usul al-fiqh, and it needs Arabic language. How do we know it's general? How do we know it's specific? How do we know it's absolute, mutlaq? How do we know if it's muqayyad? How do we know if it's mujmal? I mean, all these issues we discussed, remember about the different types of meanings and attributes of the words, you need to know all of that. So when you read that text, or that hadith which you've memorized, or you read in front of you, you're able to understand what is the hajim, right? You have to have the ability to deduce ruling from these texts. Okay? In other words, you know these ayat, you know these ahadith, you know which ones are weak, you know which ones are strong, you know what is abrogated, you know what is the abrogator, you know what the ijma has occurred, you know the usul of fiqh, you know the Arabic language. But with that, you have to have the ability to deduce rulings from these ayat and these ahadith. And that's an understanding, a quality which Allah puts in some of His slaves. It's not something that you can train yourself to deduce, right? But in reality, the strength of this, of a person to be able to deduce this, right, is something that Allah gives to who He wishes. Okay, so these are the conditions to exercise ijtihad. Now, one more principle regarding ijtihad, and then we'll do taqleed and we'll finish. Okay? Can I go ahead and erase this? I know we're coming out of the end of time. Just a few more minutes, huh? From C down, though. Okay, I'm fine. Number four, ijtihad can be possessed in some topics as opposed to others. You might possess the ability to exercise ijtihad in subjects of wudu. And in wudu, you have all the qualifications to exercise ijtihad. But when it comes to salah, it's that. When it comes to marriage and divorce, it's that. So ijtihad does not necessitate that you have the ability to exercise ijtihad in every single issue of the Sharia. But rather, once you have the ability to exercise ijtihad in a matter, then you have the right to exercise that ijtihad. Even if it's one matter of 100, 99 other matters, you don't have that ability. Okay? Like, of these 500 verses, not all of them deal with wudu. Of these 2,000 hadiths, not all of them do with wudu. Okay? Now, can we go to taqlid? You guys just a minute straight away. Okay. Whoever's writing, come over and go to taqlid. And as I said, taqlid is the last topic and we'll close the course. Finish, okay. Now,
Asi Taklif. The person who does Taklif is known as a Muqallid. Muqallid. Okay, Taklif definition is to follow someone's opinion without proof.
Follow someone's opinion without proof. That is the definition of taqlid. Types of taqlid. Taqlid is two types, general and specific. The general taqlid is that you follow like a method in every single issue. You take his opinion without proof. General taqlid is forbidden. General taqlid is forbidden. Huh? Excuse me? Forbidden by the Quran, because Allah has not allowed us to follow anyone completely in everything except for His Messenger, so to adopt the madhhab in every single issue. In other words, your Hanbali, all you care about is what the Hanbali madhhab says. You could care less if there's a hadith in the subject, if there's an ijma', if the hadith is sahih, the hadith is da'if. And you ask somebody, all you want to know is what does the Hanbali madhhab say, or the Shafi'i, or the Maliki, or the Hanafi. That's not permitted. Specific taqlid is when you follow an opinion without proof in a specific matter. This is permitted. You come to a sheikh, you say, "Ya sheikh, give me a fatwa concerning such and such. Give me a fatwa concerning such and such." Now, the sheikh doesn't give you the proof, but because you've chosen the sheikh, initially you're seeking the truth, you feel the sheikh is knowledgeable, pious, he's going to give you an answer according to the Quran and the Sunnah, so you take his thing and you act upon it. You say, "Well, I'm doing this because the sheikh informed me such." Even though you're not aware of the proof, this is permissible. This is permissible. Yes? It would fall, you would have no sin upon you. Okay, and the proof is from Surah 16, verse 43. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَاسْأَلُوا أَهْلَ الذِّكْرِ إِن كُنْتُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ. Ask those people who possess the reminder if you do not know. Allah divided people into two categories. Those who know and those who don't. And He required from those who do not to ask those who do. That's all. So therefore you're required to follow it in that case. Now, question number 3. Can a muqallid give a fatwa? In other words, the scholar has not reached the level of ijtihad. Okay, he's still, his knowledge is still within a madhhab. He's still Hanbali. Or he's still Hanafi. Or Maliki. Or Shafi'i. In his knowledge, he has not reached the level of ijtihad yet. He still works within the frame of the madhhab. Can he give a fatwa? In general, no. But it's permissible in 3 cases. Or in 2 cases. Case number 1, so in general no, but in 2 exceptions for it. That it is permissible for himself. In other words, he's a Hanbali, and so therefore he knows in his madhhab that
if a person, when it rules the book of Tahara, in Hanbali's textbook, that if in front of you you have a number of garments, a number of soaps, for instance, okay, some of which are najis, have filth on it, or some of which are haram, and you do not know which of them has najis or are forbidden, as in stolen, for instance, okay, or are made of some sort of forbidden material like silk, you cannot determine if it's silk or some sort of fine polyester. And so therefore, it's time for salah. Okay, you have four garments. Two of them, you know, are najis or let's say forbidden from silk. If you don't know which two. According to the Hanbali Mazhab, you should do salah according to the number of garments which are forbidden or najis, filthy, right? And add a salah. So if two of the four you know are forbidden or najis, how many salahs do you do? Three. Three. Because that way at least one of the salahs would have done, right? Would have been in a garment which is pure and tahir. That's their madhab. They, no other of the three madhabs agree with them in that. The other three madhabs say, yes, use your ijtihad and try to figure out which is the best and do it. So here you are a muqallid. You find yourself in this issue. You're a muqallid to the Hanbali madhab. You're starting to study. So you're still within the framework of the madhab. You haven't, in your knowledge, surpassed the madhab. It is permissible for yourself to give yourself a test. Okay? In this case. And so therefore you act upon the madhab. Two, that when there exists no mujtahid and there is a need, okay, in London, let's say there's a scholar who studied in Azhar and he's a Shafi'i scholar following the Shafi'i madhab, and there's no mujtahid who can give you a ruling according to the Quran and the Sunnah, but you have a question and you need to answer, what do you do? You go and you follow, you ask, you elicit a fatwa from this muqallid scholar. Because there's a need. Because the other choice is for you yourself to try to do something from yourself. And that is worse. So a muqallid cannot give a fatwa because he has no knowledge, because he doesn't have ijtihad, right? But it's permissible for himself to act upon that. And also, when there's no mujtahid, which is something which is available, I mean, or something which is quite common in our days, then if there's a need, he can give a fatwa. Okay, one last point concerning taqleed, and we'll wrap up the course, inshallah ta'ala. Can I go ahead and erase this? No, yeah, just to try to determine, use your best, you know, reasoning to try to exercise, to try to figure out which is the kleed or which is the halal garment. Okay, final thing. The four madhabs and the sharia. If we say this is the sharia as a whole, okay, this is Allah's religion, which He has sent down to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Remember we said that Sharia law was what? The address of the lawgiver, right? Dealing with the acts of those who are morally obligated. So these is the all the addresses of the lawgiver. And the four madhabs. What is the relationship between the two? Well, the four madhabs within them, most of the Sharia is contained. In other words, very rarely, and this is not an accurate, you know, depiction, okay? So don't say, let me say that, why I said it was 10% or 12% or whatever. In actuality, most of the four madhahib, or the opinions of the four madhahib collectively, encompass most of the sharia. So very rarely will you come to an incident where actually the ruling, okay, from the Quran and Sunnah falls outside of the four madhahib. But usually within the four madhahib, you will find Allah's ruling. Not always, but usually. Okay? Yes?
Okay, yeah, this is the next question. Do we get this point over here? Okay. The final point is that, is a Muslim required to follow a madhab? Who said yes? Is a Muslim required to follow a madhab? And the answer is no. He's required to follow Allah's religion. Okay. Now listen to this question. Can a person learn the Sharia, i.e. become a scholar, without adopting initially a madhab? Not likely. In other words, if you want to become a scholar of the Sharia, if you want to study and reach the level of ijtihad, and you do not adopt the madhab, in all likelihood you'll never reach that aim. So those brothers, or that school of thought who follow the opinion of Ash-Shawkani, he was a Yemeni scholar, lived about 200 years ago. These individuals, they say that you can just directly start studying from the hadith and so forth. Their opinion is really weak, and in the end, what they end up doing is becoming Shawkaniyun, followers of Shawkani, whether they like to admit it or not. Or in our day, a lot of them become Al-Albaniyun. Just become blind followers of Al-Albani. If you want to learn the Sharia, become a scholar, you need to initially adopt a madhab. So the way of learning is that you initially take a madhab and you learn its basic principles. Okay, and then you learn the principles with the evidences, and then you do comparative fiqh, where you study the arguments of your madhab and the other madhahib, and finally you reach ijtihad. And if Allah blesses you, that you get to that level. It's a long process; it takes many years. Okay, but when you're learning its basic principles of the madhab in your heart, what are you doing? You're saying that I should only follow the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But it's just a means for learning. Just like now, if you want to become a doctor, can you just pick up some medical textbooks and study at home? And put in the extra hours, go to the library and read all the medical journals, and you know, after a few years come out and say, okay, you know, open up an office, come on in, I'll, you know, take surgery, get a good rate. No. You have to go to medical school. And the medical school will have a specific way of teaching medicine. It might be different in another country, it might be different in another university in the same country. And at first, you're going to learn the basic principles of medicine, and you're going to advance, right, until maybe one day you'll become such a medical researcher that you'll be able to add your own opinion to the body of medical opinions. It's the same thing with Sharia studies. Just one second, okay? But if you're not learning to be a scholar, just like if you're sick now, you go to the doctor, you say, doctor, I've got this ailment. He gives you the medicine, you take it. And you go to the doctor who you feel is qualified, who's going to give you medicine, which is going to help you. You're not going to go to any quack on the street, right? And say, hey, what do you think? You know, I've got this problem. What's your best idea? So the same way, when you're doing your personal religion, if you are not studying to be a scholar, you go to that scholar who's going to give you an opinion according to what? Not according to the medicine, according to Quran and Sunnah. For your personal religion, right? But if you're studying, then you should adopt the madhab. Yes? Excuse me? Who possesses ijtihad? I mean, a number of scholars do. I mean, Ibn Baz is one scholar. Ibn Uthaymeen means another scholar possesses ijtihad. I mean, don't forget, those who possess ijtihad know who possesses ijtihad from their peers. Just like now when you go to a bunch of doctors, I mean, this room was filled with medical doctors, right? How would us, any one of us, know which is the true and the best doctor? But within themselves, right, they know which one is the good doctor and which one is the... Any science is like that, yes? No, I mean, usually it'll become from the area you're in, you know what I'm saying, or the sheikh you study with. I mean, if you study with a sheikh who's a Maliki, he's going to teach you initially according to Maliki madhab. You know, in your area of the world, there might be a prevalent madhab, you know what I'm saying? I mean, for instance, you know, one shouldn't give an example of himself. When my family is basically Hanafi from Iraq, okay? And however, though, because I studied in Saudi Arabia, I was trained according to Hanbali madhab. Huh? What? No, I mean, it's not an issue, it's just a means of studying. It's like, for instance, I was born in the United States, okay? Let's say I went to school in England, right? I would take something like the GCE, and what do you call it, O-level and A-level and stuff like that. If I went to school in the United States, if one of you went to school in the United States, you would take the SAT and so forth. I mean, it's just a means of study. I mean, it's a means of academics, you know? It's not an aim to and of itself. Yes? Yes, a woman can be a mujtahid. Remember we talked about Aisha, I don't know if I did this lecture, saying that Aisha, right, and of those 104 Sahaba who gave fatawa, number of them were women, yes. Umm Salama was one among them, yes. You should go to the one who has greater knowledge. You should always look for the one who has greater knowledge and he's going to give you an answer according to Quran and Sunnah. Okay, final thing. I'd like to thank you brothers for sitting with me over the last 8 days. I mean, Jazakallah Khairan, it was a pleasure. And I know this was very difficult. This is my first time teaching Usul al-Fiqh, so it was a little bit rough at times. But Jazakallah Khairan for your patience and for your useful comments. If you want to contact me in the United States, I'll leave you two ways to contact me. Actually, you'll contact Brother Idris. So. but he'll pass the message on to me. You can reach me by telephone or fax, 202-833-4993, and by email at sunnah@aol.com, and finally by address, by regular mail, Society for the Adherence of Sunnah. That's 2025 I Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20002, and it's Suite 903. Huh? No, the email is, you know, it's sunnah@aol.com. And I suggest that the brothers who've got their notes, that while it's still fresh in your mind, write out your notes, you know, sit together, maybe make one, you know, fill in what you missed and so forth, while it's still fresh in your mind before you forget it and so forth. Okay. Huh? Or get the tapes and fill in your notes, you know, so, yes. Okay, in English language, books which are good for this, I mentioned Al-Wami's book from Musalla Hadith. There's a book which is printed by the Islamic Text Society, by a person named Kamali, on Usul al-Fiqh by the Islamic Text Society. And there's a book by Ahmed Hassan, which is comes out of Pakistan, on Usul al-Fiqh also. Both books are very difficult to read. They're very detailed. But inshallah ta'ala, with this introductory course and, you know, that little booklet we passed out, inshallah ta'ala, huh? Oh, the book that I used, I used a number of books. I used... one book was Al-Wadih Fi Usul al-Fiqh by Umar al-Ashqar, and I used Ibn Uthaymeen's text Al-Usul by Ibn Uthaymeen, and I used Al-Rawda by Ibn Qudama, and the Shanqisi's notes on Al-Rawda, and also on Waraqat by Al-Juwaydi. Those are the main sources I used. but the Arabic book by Ibn Sa'di, which I passed out. This little thing over here in English. Huh? Inshallah, we'll see.